Good afternoon or good morning to those of you on the West. Welcome to the Talking Freight Seminar Series. My name is Nicole Cooney and I will moderate today's seminar. Today's topic is reshoring overseas manufacturing to the U.S. and North America and its impacts on the transportation system. Before I go any further, I do want to let those of you who are calling into the teleconference for the audio know that you need to mute your computer speakers or else you will be hearing your audio over the computer as well. Today we have two presentations given by Mr. Harry Moser from Reshoring Initiative and Dr. M.D. Sarter from the University of Southern Mississippi. Mr. Harry Moser founded the Reshoring Initiative to bring manufacturing jobs back to the U.S. after working for G.F. Aggie Sharmi, starting as president in 1985 and retiring in December 2010 as chairman emeritus. Mr. Moser was inducted into the Industry Week Manufacturing Hall of Fame in 2010 and named Quality Magazine's Quality Professional of the Year in 2012. In January 2013, he won the Economist debate on outsourcing and offshoring and received the Manufacturing Leadership Council's Industry Advocacy Award in 2014. In addition, Mr. Moser participated actively in President Obama's insourcing forum at the White House in January 2012. Mr. Moser received a B.S. in Mechanical Engineering and an M.S. in Engineering at MIT in 1967 and an M.B.A. from the University of Chicago in 1981. Dr. M.D. Sarter is an Associate Professor and Assistant Director for the Center for Logistics, Trade, and Transportation at the University of Southern Mississippi. He has extensive research experience in various areas, including logistics, transportation, and supply chain management. He was awarded more than 20 research grants funded by agencies including U.S. Department of Transportation, National Science Foundation, the Mississippi Department of Education, and the Mississippi Department of Transportation, and other agencies. He served as principal investigator and co-principal investigator of several U.S. DOT grants with collaborative partners from various institutions. He has authored three books, four book chapters, and over 70 scholarly interdisciplinary articles. Dr. Sarter is very active in professional organizations, including TRB, IIE, and ASEE. He served as research coordinator on AT-045 and AT-050 TRB committees. He also served as president in Lean Division, founding president of Logistics and Supply Chain Division, and Assistant Senior Vice President of Technical Operations of IIE. He served on the editorial board for several journals and Editor-in-Chief for the International Journal of Logistics and Transportation Research. Today's seminar will last for 90 minutes, with 60 minutes allocated for the speakers and the final 30 minutes for audience question and answer. If during the presentations you think of a question, you can type it into the chat area. Please make sure you send your question to everyone and indicate which presenter your question is for. Presenters will be unable to answer your questions during the presentations, but I will start off the question and answer session with the questions typed into the chat box. If we run out of time and are unable to address all questions, we will attempt to get written responses from the presenters to the unanswered questions. The PowerPoint presentations used during the seminar are available for download from the file download box in the lower right corner of your screen. Presentations will also be available online within the next few weeks, along with a recording and a transcript. I will notify all attendees once these materials are posted online. Talking Freight seminars are eligible for 1.5 certification maintenance credits for AICP members. In order to obtain credit for today's seminar, you must have logged in with your first and last name, or if you are attending with a group of people, you must type your first and last name into the chat box. I've included more detailed instructions in the file share box on how to obtain your credits after the seminar. For those of you who are not AICP members but would like to receive PDH credits for this webinar, please note that Federal Highway does not formally offer PDHs. However, it may be possible to receive PDHs for your participation in Talking Freight if you are able to self-certify. To possibly receive PDHs, please download the agenda from the file download box and submit this agenda to your respective licensing agency. Finally, I encourage everyone to please also download the evaluation form from the file share box and submit the form to me after you have filled it out. I'm now going to turn it over to Harry Moser of Reshoring Initiative to get started. Harry? Harry, are you there?
I forgot to push my hand off. Oh, sorry. So thanks, Nicole. Thanks, everybody, for being here. We're going to talk about reshoring and specifically the benefits of it for companies or perhaps transportation organizations, the costs that are involved, how to recognize costs that are perhaps higher offshore, and by reshoring, you eliminate those costs, the opportunities that arise from having a locally sourced product, and some of the considerations that should be taken into account. So we're going to go through all that, and we're going to go ahead with the next slide. So a couple of definitions for us. We call it reshoring. Some people used to call it backshoring. Sometimes you'll hear onshoring, insourcing, next shoring, right shoring. Periodically someone comes up with a new term. But it's really all about bringing back the manufacture of products that will be sold or assembled here. So for example, if GM built cars in Canada, or say they built cars in China to serve the Asian market, that's not offshoring. And therefore, since it hasn't been offshored, it can't be reshored. Because when they build cars in China, they're doing it for the Chinese or the Asian market. So it's all about products that will be sold or assembled here. Transplants or FDI, foreign direct investment, apply the same logic. So when Toyota decides to build cars in the United States for the North American market primarily, they're doing that because it's more profitable for them to make it here than it is to make it somewhere else and ship it here. And when GE brings back the production of appliances, it's because it's more profitable for them to make it here. And even though in both cases their manufacturing costs might be a little higher here, they recognize that their overhead costs come down more than their manufacturing costs go up, and therefore it makes sense to produce near the consumer. Caterpillar calls it localization, making most of its products in the region in which the product will be sold, and therefore making, let's say, most typical products in most regions rather than making all of a product in one location and shipping it all across the world. So this map gives you some feeling for that. You have reshoring is the green. Since we're primarily in the U.S., I know we have a few people here from Canada, maybe other countries, but from the perspective of the U.S., reshoring is to bring work back to the U.S. Nearshoring would be to have it bring it back from, say, Asia to either Canada or Mexico to the near shores, and then offshoring would be the rest of the world. And we since I'm an American, we encourage reshoring, but sometimes nearshoring makes a lot of sense. There might be a product that's now in China or India, and it's so labor intense that if you tried to bring it all back to the U.S., you just couldn't do it. It would stay over there. In that case, it might be better to bring the more labor intensive portions back to Mexico and the more technology or skill intensive portions to the U.S. And in effect, have the U.S. and Mexico compete with China or India. Because for the U.S., it's better to be part of the winning team than all of the losing team, which is what we'd be if we didn't make that partnership. And Canada can also play a role also, of course. Now, here's another perspective on this. So if a company has a factory in Brazil, and that factory is largely supporting the South American market, then reshoring would be bringing the work back to Brazil, and nearshoring would be everywhere else in South America, and offshoring would be the rest of the world, including the United States. So where reshoring is depends on where you're sitting, where the factory is, and what market you're supplying. A lot of the work went offshore because of faulty math by the companies. The majority of them looked only at simple total cost models. They looked at wage arbitrage. Where can I get the lowest wage rate? Or PPV, purchase price variance. Where can I buy the product or make the product with the lowest standard manufacturing cost? But maybe a little more sophisticated, what's my landed cost? So price, duty, freight, packaging, to get it to the dock here or to the $1,000, they were all different. And then each year going forward, adjust that for the change in the average wage rate within manufacturing and for the currency relative to the dollar and for the productivity in the country. So for the U.S., it's pretty simple. We've had roughly 2% wage increases and roughly 2% productivity increases, so it stays roughly flat at 100. The other countries are largely changing due to currency. China is the outlier up here with a total of about 400 in the year 2014. So their unit labor cost expressed in dollars is about four times as high as it was before, and the U.S. has stayed constant. So that has significantly closed the labor cost gap between the two, make the U.S. relatively more competitive, U.S. and all other countries. So based on this kind of data and analysis, the Boston Consulting Group, which has done quite a bit of publishing and study in this area, predicted back in 2011 and 2012 that by about 2015, so that's now, that net labor costs for manufacturing in China and the U.S. would converge. So what they meant was not that the labor cost per hour would converge or even the labor cost per unit of output, but rather that the total cost would converge, because that labor cost gap would get small enough that when you then looked at the duty and the freight and the packaging and the carrying cost of inventory and the travel costs and the intellectual property risk and the opportunity cost, because you occasionally lose orders because you can't deliver timely, and the quality impacts and the impacts on innovation, depending on whether you have the factory near engineering or far away from engineering. When you look at all those things, when you take a look at the total cost, the numbers would converge by about 2015, so that's now, and that specifically that would happen in the southeastern states and Texas, the relatively lower wage rate areas of the country, and then working its way north year by year as the Chinese wages continue to go up. And the Chinese wages have been going up at about 15% per year for the last 15 years, and realistically will continue to do so because it's largely driven by two things. Most importantly, the one-child policy. So even if they started to, if they changed that and started to have lots of babies, it would be 16 years or 18 years till they had more workers. So the supply of labor falling off dramatically. At the same time, the demand for labor is up dramatically because of their 7% or more growth rate in the economy. So dramatic things happening. So the reshoring initiative, that's my group, provides several things to help accelerate this process. So first is this total cost of ownership estimator, so TCO, total cost of ownership, that helps calculate or quantify all of those costs that I mentioned. Companies use it for sourcing, making their decision, where should I source this product or component, or where should I site that plant, and suppliers can use it to sell to the bigger company, to show the bigger company that their local product has some advantages and economic value to the company that is not expressed in the price differential. We also have a library that has 2,400 articles about reshoring, and you can go in there and see what's happening in your state, in your industry that you're especially interested in. You can do all kinds of slicing and dicing and find a lot of interesting things. We have all kinds of statistics that I'm going to show you from that. We have a case studies template, a place to report cases. So if any of your companies or clients or customers have reshored, you can go there and post that on our website, get free publicity for the customer, for the company that's done it, and also whoever reports gets a free manufacturing is cool t-shirt made in the U.S. out of U.S.
supply chain needs and
we provide solutions for major supply chain problems. We obviously went through the West Coast
industrial
dispute that had delayed some things by weeks and months, and that issue would not have been true if the products and components were being sourced domestically. Another major problem in manufacturing is the skilled work. workforce shortage, the shortage of toolmakers, precision machinists, welders, people like that. And it's not surprising that we have that shortage because the smart students read about offshoring and post-industrial society, and the best way to convince them to consider going into those very well-paid, very viable careers is to see that reshoring is happening and the work isn't just going away anymore, but it's starting to come back. So the total cost of ownership, TCO, estimator, if you answer a bunch of questions about the U.S. source and the offshore source, in this case we did it against China, and in this case the Chinese price was 70 and the U.S. price was 100, and so the logical thing for the purchasing or procurement person was to say, of course, I'll source it from China. But when they did TCO, it came out to 98 and 108. So now a 10% difference instead of a 30% difference. And then looking forward, seeing that in about 3 years, the total cost of ownership will be higher in China than from the U.S., then hopefully the company will decide to expand, to hire, to train, to find local sources to improve its transportation network of all the incoming products that it has received, because it now makes strategic sense to produce more here for the U.S. market. So we take the data from the users who have done their analyses online, and we took a batch of them and called the total cost 100%, and saw that the landed cost on average was 87% of that, the purchase price was 77%. And so the red portions show the portion of the total cost that is not captured when you use those more simplistic measures. Another way of looking at the data, we took the first, I think, 19 cases of China versus the U.S., and when from the data that the users had run, in about 5% of the cases, the U.S. had the lower price, but in about 53% of the cases, had the lower total cost. So the difference, 48%, we think is probably a little extreme, so we conservatively say that about 25% of what's offshore would be reshored if the companies shifted from those more simplistic measures such as price over to total cost for making the decision. So in addition to our total cost of ownership estimator, there's another system that has been put out by this professor Suzanne de Treville, who's at the University of Lausanne in Switzerland. She's an American. She's also taught often at Harvard and MIT, and a very sharp lady. Her system takes two of the cost factors that are in the TCO estimator and specifically says, when I change from a long delivery time, like a couple of 3 months, say, down to a short delivery time, like maybe 2 weeks, because I have local sourcing and get just-in-time deliveries, what does that do to the amount of orders I lose because of stocking out? And what does it do to the amount of inventory I have to dispose of at a discount because it's past the season or it's past its life or something like that? And so by using her system, here's a typical example of this. You fill in the blanks over here with various measures of the price and the cost and the disposal value and the volatility of demand, and then it automatically generates a curve like this. And in this case, concluded that you could afford to pay 39% more for the locally sourced product with a short lead time as opposed to the product with a long lead time. Now, the 39% is probably not a typical case. Probably a typical case might turn out to be 15% or something like that. And you can then take that, add it to the output of the TCO estimator, but knock off the opportunity cost and disposal cost or obsolescence cost on the estimator, add the two together, and you might then come out with 25% or 30% in total. And I'm going to give you at the end of this links to all the things.
Yeah.
Most of you know what lean is, and Deming, who really got the thing going,
said,
so it sounds, intuitively obvious, sounds like something Moses might have had on the tablet. How could anybody disagree with it? And yet, most of the companies that brag about their lean program, programs and their continuous improvement continuously ignore this key principle. So I've, to help all of you see this, I've made a list here of the 7 Toyota wastes, so the wastes that are listed in the Toyota production system, and then shown here in the right-hand column how offshoring makes each waste worse. And I highlighted in red the 4 areas that seem most related to freight, so you can see how this, you know, contributes to offshoring being expensive and how reshoring would contribute to offshoring being, would contribute to total cost being less expensive. So the single best case of reshoring is GE bringing back appliances from a contract manufacturer in China to their own facility in an appliance park in Louisville. And this is a huge move on their part. It's a big factory. Used to have 22,000 people, has traffic lights in the parking lot. It was down to about 2,000 people, and they invested about $1 billion, hired 1,300 people, renovated a big portion of the facility. And the way they did it, they brought in units of each of the appliances that they were making, having made for them offshore, and put them in a war room, and had the design engineers, the marketing people, the factory workers, the foremen, the suppliers, all tore these things apart and figured out smarter ways to put them together. And when they were done, and they were making it here in the U.S., the thermal efficiency was improved, the warranty costs were reduced, and even though the wage rate per hour of the workers in the U.S. is 5 times as high as it was in China, the retail price of the Made in USA product is 20% lower than the retail price was when they were importing the product from China. So just a total win-win-win. You can't always be, they worked hard to do it, and it can't always work out that well, but it's a wonderful sign that it's possible to make happen. So another big case here is Walmart. So Walmart has announced a $250 billion increase in their U.S. purchase of manufactured goods, starting at zero in the first year and ending in 2022, the 10th year, at an incremental $50 billion per year, which we calculate to be about 300,000 manufacturing jobs incremental. So that alone is a 2% or something like that increase in total U.S. manufacturing jobs. Boston Consulting Group says it will be 1 million total jobs when you include the multiplier effect on the incremental jobs around manufacturing. Another interesting case here, I've worked with Mori Corp, which makes industrial circuit boards, for example, for Caterpillar, Deere, people like that. They're here in Illinois. And they were having a problem. They had a housing they were bringing in from China, and it was, I think it leaked. It had some kind of a quality issue, really tough with them and their customers. And the customers insisted that Mori sourced the product here in the U.S., and they did so, and they fixed the quality problem. But equally or more important, they reduced the inventory by 94%. They reduced the inventory by a factor of 18, because they didn't have the long pipeline. They didn't have the big piles just in case the container didn't arrive and just in case the stuff in the container was bad. So a factor of 18, we think a factor of 2 or 3 might be fairly common and that a company could probably count on. But you know how hard the companies work to improve turns, reduce inventory. The simplest way to do it is to source locally, have just-in-time delivery, slash inventory dramatically. So related to the issue of quality, here's a case of Daily Hydropower that brought in hydraulic cylinders from India. And one of the biggest issues they'd have, you know, they'd be sitting there with, you know, delivery's not so good, and then a container comes in, and they open the container, and most of the cylinders are bad, and now delivery's just got a lot worse. And then they say to themselves, well, it's not so bad. A week behind that, there's another one on a container ship, and a week behind that, there's another one. If those are good, we're okay. We're going to survive this. We're not going to lose our customers. But if those are bad also, then we're really, really going to lose our customers. So do you sit and wait for the container fly to India, make good units, air freight the units over at a cost that wipes out your quarter's profits. And there's no way to solve the problem because you can't get into the containers that are buried on the container ship. Whereas if you make the product here yourself, or you have it made 50 or 100 miles away, you go to the factory, you make sure the problem's fixed, and you've lost a day or two of production, but you haven't, you don't have that great unsolvable problem because here you can get access to the information you need. So to take a sort of a 60,000 foot view of this, back roughly 10 years ago, we were losing net about 140,000 manufacturing jobs a year to offshore. And now we're gaining net about 10,000 jobs. So we've gone from a huge loss that was just hollowing out U.S. manufacturing to a net gain, a small net gain, but a huge improvement over the 140,000 that we were losing in the past. So we take our library, which I mentioned has these 2,400 articles, and as of the end of 2014, we took all of the cases that we knew of and sorted them by industry. These are basically NAICS code industries, and we show how many jobs and how many cases, or cases is a company or a division, like GE might have two or three cases, Caterpillar has a couple of cases. And so you can see a tendency towards automotive and other transportation equipment, appliances, machinery, so tendency towards bigger, heavier stuff where the transocean freight and all the inventory never probably made especially good sense before, and now increasingly does not. Here we've listed the, from all those cases, we've listed the reasons, the negative things about being offshore. So again, I've highlighted in red the items that relate most to you, freight cost, delivery, supply chain interruption, travel costs, and moving bodies, in this case, instead of things. So you can see relatively where what's important. And the ones I mentioned would all be related to distance. And then some would be specific to a country. So, for example, quality or intellectual property risk might be more likely to be a risk in China than in Germany or Switzerland or Canada. Here are the positive reasons to reshore, the things that they said they found better here. So the image brand, the fact that the product is made in the United States, the main market is made in USA. Often automation's involved, higher productivity. So if you use the same productivity level as you had in China, probably you can't justify bringing it back. Often they redesigned the parts, so something like that innovation that I talked about. Government incentives are fairly common, and there's probably some that aren't mentioned in our sources. Walmart, as I mentioned, in a significant number of cases, companies say they did it because of Walmart. Natural gas, chemicals, we read a lot about that. So there's a variety of causes, many of which, if you simplify it down, proximity or doing it in the home country is one of the major factors. About 60% of the work came back from China. Prevalence here of China, the China that, say, 5 years ago, one would never have thought we could bring that much back from China. Very little from Europe, so you can see there's Italy, Hungary, and there's a couple of others if you go further down the list to the ones and twos. So why the difference? I think because in China, the companies mainly outsourced, whereas in Europe, they maybe built their own factories or bought a competitor over. In China, there's the intellectual property risk and the high wage rates, et cetera. Not so true in Europe. There's a lot of differences like that, longer-term relationship, maybe better language, all kinds of things like that, that have tended to keep the relationship stronger in Europe than in Asia. The work has tended to go to the southeast in Texas, more or less as Boston Consulting Group had predicted. So you can see here the mix by state of number of jobs, number of cases. You can see the jobs per facility. So typically the big greenfield facilities go into the southeast in Texas, this has impact on the economy. We've had, I think, good but not great support from Washington, a lot of interest from the Commerce Department. We work closely with the MEPs and the groups that are, you know, some linked up here, the Manufacturing Extension Partnerships, and with Select USA, that's the foreign direct investment arm of the Commerce Department, worked actively with them. Back in January of 2012, I got two calls from Washington. One was from this U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission, the other, the White House National Economic Council. And I was, they both wanted to know how to bring manufacturing jobs back from China, and I was obviously delighted to hear from them instead of having two calls from Washington, one from the FBI and the other from the IRS. That would have made my day as well. So that resulted the next week in being at the White House Indian Sourcing Forum, and here's obviously the president, and this is Harry over here with the glasses on speaking to the president, and I was giving him some tips with the State of the Union message that was coming up in a few weeks, and he had me sent the message, but I didn't get into the State of the Union. That afternoon, this was a C-SPAN panel with the bald guy here making some points. So I mentioned skilled workforce. Many of you, or most of you, are transportation companies. So you don't have so many tool makers and machinists, but you have mechanics and the maintenance people and so on. So I suspect you're having problems finding them. So I just wanted to highlight this. About 2 years ago, the Department of Labor, U.S. Department of Labor, called me down to Washington to advise them on how to get the workforce ready for reshoring. And so we're in the Secretary of Labor's conference room, and I stood up and said, well, I think first we have to recognize that the Department of Labor has been part of the problem and has to become part of the solution. Fortunately, they didn't kick me out, and they said, okay, wise guy, what do you mean? So I pulled up their Bureau of Labor Statistics website and said, here's what you're telling the public. You've got income going up with number of degrees, and it's headlined education pays, and this is what the educators, the guidance counselors, the professors, et cetera, all use to say everybody's got to go to university because they'll all make more money and we'll have a better economy. And I say, well, you know, it isn't literally true. This should say education and training pay, and we should have in here the average income of someone who's passed an apprenticeship or has, you know, five or more certificates from NIMS or AWS or something like that to show that there are other ways to win. And this is especially true because the Labor Department is responsible for the apprenticeships and the certificates. And instantly, they said, yes, they agreed 100%, and they went ahead and they changed the wording maybe halfway to what I wanted. And they're doing the survey to get the data on the apprenticeship. So I was delighted that they were so responsive. So based on that success, we have a program for skilled workforce recruitment. And so, for example, we recommend that in your company, in your community, you do what the Swiss and the Germans do. You get rid of the terms trades and vocations. You call them professions. So someone is a toolmaking in the toolmaking profession or the plumbing profession. And you train them really well, and they make a good income, and it's a profession. Get rid of the term middle skills. Who wants a middle skill job? We recommend going, instead of high, middle, and low skill, go to academic, technical, and manual skills. So instead of suggesting a hierarchy, instead be more descriptive in the terminology. And then in your community, get the companies to all report when they reshore, and get the local media to report that, so that the students and the guidance counselors see that reshoring is happening and that it's safe for students to become a welder. We also have an economic development plan. It's in place in Pennsylvania and Mississippi, and basically it goes to a company called DataMine and gets the data on all the imports coming in through the U.S. ports, and then the state says, okay, that's what's coming into my state. What company is it going to, and who's ordering it? And let's go to the guys that are ordering a lot, and we can convince them to have it made here instead. Go to them. Why aren't you making it here in Pennsylvania? The prices are too high. Yeah, but is the total cost of ownership too high? Educate them on total cost, and in some cases, they decide to bring the work back. So far, I think we have suffered because of offshoring. The companies are used to, let's say, make products for the, you know, components for the OEM, or in your case, used to transport components for the OEM, to come to our group and say, I used to transport a lot for that company, but now we don't do that anymore because they're making so much of it offshore. And, okay, then we'll go in, call on the company, and do our best to convince them to bring the manufacturing back so you can transport more goods for them. So that's an interesting. Let us know. Things that you can do to help reshoring, use the tools. You know, if you can convince companies to stay in your territory so you can do transport for them, that's great. Everything's free at the website. We have archived webinars like this one. Certainly use this one. We have more of them. You can post a link, get me to speak at your customer industry conferences to help soften them up, submit cases of reshoring, win that t-shirt that I talked about. How we can help you, we have data. You can look up who's reshoring in your region, because maybe they could tip the reshoring, they're doing more manufacturing, they ought to need some transportation to help that happen. We can train you, we can help with the analysis, we can promote your successes. So these are I'm an amateur on trade. FD and all of you are the experts, but I, you know, from my knowledge of reshoring, here's what I think will happen. Relatively less incoming border freight. Now, by definition, if you have reshoring, it means there's just less imports. Fewer distribution centers close to the border. It isn't coming in at the border anymore like at the ports, and therefore the distribution centers don't need to be near the ports especially. Maybe a little less train freight because there's a lot of trains moving completed products from those ports to the distribution centers or distribution centers on further. More production, especially in the Southeast, Texas, the Midwest, and Mexico. Perhaps more distribution centers closer to the production. Probably somewhat more truck traffic, especially for local and regional component delivery. So instead of moving complete products from an ocean port to a distribution center to a retail store, instead there's going to have to be a lot of motion of hundreds of components into an assembly plant in the U.S. where the product will be assembled and then shipped from there. Probably a little more exports, because you can't export something if you don't have the industrial capability to make any of that, if you're not making any of that category. So to the extent that we rebuild our capability to make products that we're not now making, there's an opportunity for export. So maybe we'll get a better balance of imports and exports, which should be some of your benefits. Some of the tools that we provide, I've listed here. The ACE tool is Assess Costs Everywhere. It's a Commerce Department site that lists data that can be useful in doing our analysis. The cost differential frontier I showed you with that graph that showed the 39%. Here's our estimator. We have a how-to guide to get a company going on it. There's the library. Submit a case study, economic development program. Most of the things I talked about are linked here, so you can find them if you choose to do so. We're a not-for-profit. We have 38 sponsors. You can see some of them here. Bank of America, for example. For some reason, it doesn't say AMT, which is the Association for Manufacturing Technology, which puts on the IMTS, the big show in Chicago every other year, and a variety of trade associations, manufacturing groups, etc., machine tool makers, a whole bunch more here. And this is my last slide. Before I go through that, I'm going to mention that my plan is to include all of you on our mailing list for our next 6 times per year newsletter. And in the newsletter, it's right immediately obvious how to cancel if you don't want to get it. So if any of you don't want to receive it, as soon as you get it, just cancel and bam, you're off the list. You'll never receive it again, I promise. I'm assuming that the fact that you showed up for the webinar means that you're interested enough to at least take a look. This gives you a chance to get some continued interaction with us. So this is the final slide. This is how we think of ourselves. This little Dutch boy. Little Dutch boys in Holland, and the dike keeps the North Sea out of Holland, especially during the storm. storm, and without the dike, everything's flooded, and there's no food. And so a little Dutch boy is walking along, and he sees a hole in the dike, and the water's coming out, and the little stones are coming out. Big stones are shaking a little bit. He says, wow, this is going soon. We're going to be flooded, not for a year. So he has to decide, should I go run and get the village elders to repair the dike, or should I stick my finger in the hole and hold it together? And he goes for the finger story. And so conceptually, this is the U.S., this is offshoring, this is Harry when Harry had hair, and you are the village elders. And if you say, well, that's a nice presentation, then, but don't do anything, well, then the economy doesn't get better the way it could, the jobs won't be as good for your children and grandchildren. Whereas if you take advantage of this and use it in your companies, use it to convince your customers, then the U.S. will be a better economy and a better place for all of us to live. So that's the end of my slide. And thanks for listening.
Thank you, Harry. We will now move on to M.D. Sarter of the University of Southern Mississippi. M.D.?
Yes, I'm here. Good morning and good afternoon to many of you. Thanks, Harry, for the presentation that lays out the foundation for reshoring in some cases that it's not something like we're dreaming. It's really happening now. So I'll be talking about a project that's funded by U.S. DOT through CFIRE Consortium. And here we're trying to identify, okay, if reshoring happens, that what would be the impact on transportation infrastructures and the U.S. economy? This is the multidisciplinary, multi-institutional project. Our project partners coming from USM, University of Southern Mississippi, University of Wisconsin-Madison, University of Memphis, and also University of Huntsville, Alabama. So in this project, we have multiple objectives. We're trying to identify a dimensionless reshoreability index for the manufacturing companies in the U.S. And so like Jerry talked about, different factors that contributing to reshoring decisions, and he's trying to quantify those factors into cost items so that it's easy to compare. But we are trying to identify the reshoreability index for manufacturing companies. In that particular case, the individual company do not have to do those calculations. If they belong to particular manufacturing industry, then they can see, so our companies are actually doing the reshoring, so maybe our time. So again, we are looking kind of a little broader to see what are the different companies that are willing to reshore, or maybe it's ready for them to reshore. We would also like to do something like the manufacturing location quotient analysis within the CFIRE region. Again, the CFIRE region is the consortium funded by the U.S. DOT, and as you can see on the map below, that there are 11 universities involved with that, so we are considering in this particular region where these universities are located, so these few states. As part of this project, we also would like to see the potential impact, as I mentioned, for reshoring on the freight networks within this region, and maybe to identify the rationales, like, okay, what are the distribution scenarios if reshoring happens? I think Eddie alluded to that reshoring is kind of, it's happening, but how many companies will bring back, or it's not going to be instantaneous, even though the industry know that, okay, we need to reshore, but it's not going to be happening within a year or two, because if they already invested a lot of money in factories in China and some other parts, so they cannot close it immediately. It's going to take some time. And also, here in back in the U.S., maybe all these infrastructures are not ready yet to do the reshoring. So it's going to take over time. So we would like to see the distribution scenario analysis on the freight. Okay, so we are getting all these containers through different ports in the U.S. Well, are we going to be getting the same amount? What would be the impact on that? And then Okay, so if we know that, and then how that's going to be impacting the networks, the roads, and the rails. We also would like to see that how that's going to be impacting the economy for these particular states and the locations. And part of this project, we would like to develop a web-based tool that, you know, that anybody can use it. Hopefully that would be helpful. So in this project, our focus is limited to things I'm going to be mentioning right now. As I say, that is, we're not going to be able to do for the whole U.S. We're going to be only locating for, you know, targeting for the CFI regions. And we divided these things into two, Memphis and South and Chicago and North. So just if we make it two distribution points, so these are the two distribution points. When you're talking about this reshoring, we are talking only about the manufacturing operations, not the, you know, service reshoring, call center reshoring, and not those. And for this particular project, we are also focusing between U.S. and China, not any other countries. It's going to be too broad for us, and I'm sure not, that's not within our budget as well. Regarding the transportation and distribution part, we are focusing only the major U.S. ports that leads or that delivers those containers to those regions I just mentioned, the Memphis and South and Chicago and North. So it's not going to be all U.S. ports, but the major U.S. ports that actually receive those containers and ship it to this particular area. And as I mentioned, that we'll be focusing only on road, rail, and the multimodal, the combining road and rail. Again, this project is funded by USDOT, and we got the funding late in the last year. So this project is still in the beginning phase. We are expected to finish by end of the year. At that point, I would be able to share with you more results. So right now, I'll be talking about just what kind of results we are looking for, or we are anticipating to. As I mentioned that we would like to see the reshoreability and the index for manufacturing companies, and when we are doing those things, what are the different factors that are driving for reshoring? If you look at 1980s and 90s, and even in the beginning of 2000s, a lot of companies went for offshoring. They saw some benefits there. But Harry mentioned that those benefits are kind of when they saw in the beginning, but in reality, it's not that much benefit. And because of the administration changes in policy, Made in America movement, bringing operations back to U.S., and all those kind of things are, you know, erasing those benefits completely. So now, maybe there are a lot of companies will bring their operations back. But they need to have some information that, okay, what operations do you need to bring back? Not all operations we can afford to bring back because we're not ready. So we would like to see what are the factors that are driving the reshoring. Harry mentioned several factors on TCO cost analysis. So what are those factors? We are done with these things at this point. We identified several factors, but we're going to be focusing on top, you know, 15 or 20 factors and see what are the relationship between these factors and the manufacturing companies who are doing the offshoring right now. And when we're going to be doing those things, we'll focus on manufacturing companies with the four-digit NAICS codes. Three-digit sometimes is kind of a little broader, so we would like to go into the details into four digits. Based on the relationship and the factors, we would like to develop the RI, the reshoreability index, and that will tell the manufacturing company, hey, if you are falling in this particular category, yes, it's time for you to start bringing operations back. If you are in this particular industry, maybe you're not ready. You're not going to be able to bring back. And also, at the same time, if you have some manufacturing companies who are in the middle, they are going to be deciding, okay, well, we just still need to wait. So now, once we develop that thing, we would like to validate this index with the existing studies or public studies that like reshoring initiatives, they already have the list of all those companies who are reshoring. And Harry Moser, he's actually advisor of this project, so that is a, you know, great help for us. Also, BCZ, the Boston Consulting Group, and some other companies, they already have those things and published those lists. So we would like to validate our index with that. On top of that, we also like to see the sensitivity analysis varying the factors. For some companies, those factors, some factors are important. But over time, maybe those importance level goes down or up. So we would like to vary those factors and see how that's going to be impacting the index. So, you'll be looking something like in this slide. We have several industries, textile industries, food manufacturing industries, paper manufacturing industries, chemical industries, and so on. And if we develop a index, something like that, and in this particular case, you can see on the left side, 0 to 10, these are the reusability index from 1 to 10 scale. And this particular purple bars, that represents that particular industry. What's that index? So, for example, if you look at transportation equipment industry, you can see that the reusability index is somewhere a little above 8. Or machinery manufacturing, you see somewhere like 10, and so on. And for textile industry, it's almost close to 0. Toy manufacturing is somewhere, 0.3 or so. So that tells that will give us information, especially for the manufacturing industries. Oh, okay. So we are falling in this category, like heavy equipment manufacturing industry. Maybe it's time for us to start bringing that. Or if you look at the textile industries versus the equipment industry, you can see that this is very labor-intensive industry. America is still not ready yet. Like if we consider the chip manufacturing, circuit manufacturing, we do have very highly substituted manufacturing process here and tools. We can compete with overseas. But for textile industries, the manufacturing is so labor-intensive and complicated, that it's now a standard process that we can use here. We still have to rely on levers. And I think that's still not ready. Maybe that will be changing if we come up with a different re-engineering process or something like that. And how we validate like these things, if you see that on the top right here, you see the list of companies that BCZ, the Boston Consulting Group, identified. Okay, these are some companies they should bring their operation span. So that's the way we're going to be validating whether this index makes sense or not. And that would be a great tool for the industries, especially manufacturing industries, to see, okay, where do we belong and what are the next actions we need to do. Another part of the research, we would like to see the location quotient analysis. So we would like to see where these individual manufacturing companies are located right now. And if we can cluster them, okay, hey, most of these transportation equipment manufacturing companies, most of them, the chip manufacturing companies are right here. So we can see the locations and identify, okay, so what are the, so if you look at here, the quotients, some of them are very green and very blue. And you can see, okay, these are the companies located concentrically right here. So we, based on this information, we can identify what are the potential impacts going to be. Should we, when we bring the operations back, do we establish a, White House Center close to this region? Or is there anything that if we have to make a plan for transportation, where do we invest? Maybe somewhat close to that. So we would like to see in that particular region. And this is an example not based on our research. This is a research done by actually Ben and Teresa from University of Wisconsin Medicine and presented at the PRB 2014. We also would like to see, as I mentioned, that what are the distribution analysis, scenario analysis for the chains, expected chains that happens because of the reshoring. Like here, you can see that different U.S. ports right here, all the U.S. ports. And then right now, this is a part of the project we finished actually last year for international capacity expansion So if, you know, the capacity increases through the Panama Canal, then how does that be impacting the U.S. infrastructure? We would like to see a similar thing here. So if reshoring happens, right now the volume is very, you know, insignificant. But maybe next 5 years, that will make a big change. So we would like to see the difference between freight coming in through the China and through this mega U.S. ports. And we can lay out that difference and see how that's going to be impacting the rail network as well as the road network. Eddie mentioned maybe in the rail, it's going to be less, you know, movement versus the train, but we would like to see how that's going to be happening really. And based on that, you can see, we would like to see that, okay, where that impact is going to be. Like, for example, some infrastructure, some network could be congested, so, especially in the south. Like, if we see that more and more reshoring things are happening, maybe they will be selecting the region where their labor cost is cheaper, where the, you know, cost of operations that are cheaper. So maybe in the south part or southeast or Texas, somewhere we may see some bottlenecks. Maybe it frees up some bottleneck we used to see, you know, before reshoring. So those are the things that we would like to see from this particular research. Another part is to see the economic impact because of the changes of the containers or movement because of the reshoring. So if you see that, so in the next 5 years, if we see that, okay, that containers coming from China is going to be less, okay, how is going to, and there are more and more companies is going to be within the state. So how is that going to be impacting in terms of GSP or, you know, GDP? We also can identify, okay, so in this particular figure, if you see that there's some blue dots, these are the regions, the previous research we identified, okay, these are the regions that's going to be the bottlenecks, or these are the areas that has the potential to expand. So the transportation planners, and those people who are interested to invest, they can focus on this particular area to identify, okay, yeah, maybe we need to expand these things. Maybe we need to build a new, you know, infrastructure here. So that's where we are at this point. Again, this is research ongoing. We do not have any preliminary results at this point. We are expecting to finish it by December. And at this point, I am looking for some help from, you know, many of you that, you know, sometimes when we try to convert these factors into decisions, we would like to quantify that relationship. And it's very hard sometimes. Sometimes there are some factors that are subjective factors. It's hard to come up with a relationship. So if any of you know some data that can help us to form that relationship, that would be really appreciated, that how, why companies reshore, what are the different factors, and what are the really established relationship between those factors and the decision. We also would like to see some help with the real-time reshoring data from U.S. manufacturing companies. I know that most of you are working for the transportation, but if you know somebody, if you're involved with somebody who are actually doing some reshoring, that'd be nice. We would like to see some reshoring real data, and that would be helpful for validate our model. Finally, we would like to get some access to the databases. We do have some databases, but those are very limited in scope to identify the difference between the freight that's going to be coming in right now versus in the next 5 years or so. So we need some kind of database like that. And once our project is over, we will be posting these things in our website. The website is listed right here. So at that point, you should be able to see the tools and the final report as well. So again, I am not able to share with you too much about the results, but that's our goal. That's what we are doing. And again, hopefully by end of this year, you should see a better, you know, concrete picture of our project. Thank you very much. And this is my contact information if you would like to send some, you know, database or something.